Hello, I'm Darren Grimes, and you're listening to Live from Lord North Street, a podcast from the Institute of Economic Affairs. The adage that the Church of England is the Conservative Party at prayer still has force, with Church of England worshippers more likely to vote for the Conservative Party. So it might be thought that these political opinions would go hand in hand with favourable views of free enterprise, free trade, and lower taxes. However, Archbishop of Canterbury Justin Welbury's recent blistering attack on the gig economy and zero-hours contracts, branding them the reincarnation of an ancient evil, is there a case, a Christian case, for capitalism to be made? And if so, why are we not making it? Joining me to discuss is Philip Booth, Senior Academic Fellow at the Institute of Economic Affairs, and Marcus Walker, the rector of St. Bartholomew's. So I was inspired to do this and get you both in after I read your Telegraph response to Archbishop Welby's comments at the TUC conference.
Yes.
He even went as far as to say that the wealthy should pay more tax, adding that we cannot continue with an economy that works so badly for so many. Now, when you've got record employment, when you've got youth unemployment at a record low as well, all of these things suggest that actually the economy seems to be working quite well. Is it the decline of religion that means we're looking for morality elsewhere? And that's why we're turning more to the state and left-leaning politics? What do you think, Philip?
I think you could argue that the decline of religion has, if you like, led people to want to replace God by a different God, the state, and he wants the state to do things which previously not just religious organisations but religiously inspired people and religiously inspired organisations would have done in the past. However, this isn't especially new. There were a strong Christian socialist movement in the 1930s which some argue led directly into the sort of intellectual case, if you like, for the welfare state, and of course in the 1980s you had Faith in the City. So socialist views amongst religious people, it's not by any means an entirely new thing. Of course, in a sense, even if the people at large want to replace religion by a different god, the state, we are actually talking about religious people here. So that raises the question, why is it that Justin Welby, perhaps, and others in the Anglican Church wants the state to do those things which perhaps other institutions in society ought to be doing?
Marcus, do you feel that disconnect? Do you feel that there is a real disconnect between the elites in the Church of England and those who, you know, your average worshipper?
I mean, the first thing I suppose that it's worth saying is that all Christians are concerned with that basic cry to look after the poor, the fatherless and the widow. That runs throughout the Old Testament. It runs throughout the New Testament. Christians of all different sorts of political stripes have tried to answer this in different ways. Now, what's interesting at the moment is that you have such a divide between the laity, who every poll suggests lean pretty much towards the Cameronite right, pretty much fiscally conservative and socially liberal, whilst the clergy lean in a more statist, in a more left-wing direction. Possibly that's because the clergy spend a lot of their time dealing with those who really are on the margins of society, who really are the people who haven't benefited from the huge expansion of wealth and of longevity and of health that's happened over the last 30 years since the explosion of the free market around the world, and that might encourage them to look for solutions that have been around for the last 100, 200 years that perhaps the rest of society, or indeed an awful lot of society, would say haven't worked. I think perhaps what we're seeing here is people responding from the heart to situations that they see in their parishes and in their dioceses. I personally suspect that that's the reason why you see such a disconnect between the clergy and the people in the pews.
Philip, if you look at some of Jesus' own sayings, they do seem distinctly, some of them, anti-capitalist. For example, it is easier for a camel to go through the eye of a needle than for a rich man to enter the kingdom of God.
Well, there's nothing anti-capitalist about warning people about the difficulties which riches bring. In fact, sometimes when I'm talking about the the top 1%. And when it comes to inequality in society, the only thing that's really changed in the last 30 years in the UK is that the top 1% have pulled away from the bottom 9% of the top 10%. So you've got a lot of people who, I think largely because of globalisation, have become very rich, whilst the rest of the income distribution has stayed pretty much the same. When I'm talking about this, I often make the point that that's a bigger problem for the top 1% than it is for everybody else, because it's a huge responsibility having those kinds of riches. And it's not anti-capitalist for Jesus to warn people of those responsibilities. And if you try to, of course people can interpret the Bible in different ways, but if you try to look for direct examples within the New Testament, at least, whereby it's argued that you should have a state bureaucracy which is taking decisions to take income or wealth off one group of people and distribute it to another group of people, those things are pretty thin on the ground. There are lots of other statements about wealth, how the community as a whole should behave, how churches should behave in terms of ensuring the distribution of wealth, caring for widows and orphans and all the rest of it, but there's very little that's said about the state as such.
And Marcus, economic freedom broadly allows people the dignity of making their own moral choices and to reason and act purposely in a way, you know, they can follow their own vocation in life, promote virtue such as hard work, thrift and reliability. Does that necessarily have to make a market economy individualistic? You know, you've got that argument that it's Thatcherism that has destroyed Britain. It's talking about the individual constantly.
Yes, I suppose one of the mistakes that people make, I would suggest, when assessing this ethically, is to say that the market or the free market itself is either ethically good or ethically bad. It is neither. It is the way in which people interact, and it's mediated by people, and it's mediated by governments trying to control or regulate it. It's the people who are interacting with each other who have the ethical virtues or lack the ethical virtues, which makes each exchange or each market ethical or unethical, in a way. I would say right now, the twin sins that we're seeing, if we can put, well, I suppose I should put them that way, I'm a clergyman, the twin sins that really dominate our ethical discourse are avarice, the old sin of greed, and envy. So the question of how do you make your money is really much more important than the question of do you make money or how much money do you make. If you're making your money in an ethical and good way and you're looking after your workers and you're ensuring that you're not deliberately defrauding those whom you're selling to and you're not selling people things that will kill them or will deliberately harm them, well, that's good. If you are doing those things, I mean, that is wicked. On the other hand, if you're looking at other people and thinking, I want that house, I want her car, I want that which I haven't earned, that envy is also dangerous. That envy is also a sin. Sailing between those two rocks, the Scylla and Charybdis, in the market economy, I suppose in any economy, is really our job as the church, ensuring that people know how to behave ethically towards one another, how to view their fellow human beings.
And Thatcher herself, of course, really understood that the market economy wasn't individualistic. In her famous There Is No Such Thing as Society quote, with the appendix that was added later, I have to say it's a bit jumbled ethically and rather clumsy, but actually she was saying that we shouldn't confuse the state with society, and that what she really believed in was a strong society with people behaving ethically within society. She didn't actually say this in this piece, but she would have believed this. But the state is no replacement when people don't behave ethically in society. If you have the same kind of people who we identify as behaving unethically in the business world, actually with power in the political world, they can create a huge lot more damage in that position than they can in the position of running a business. At least when you're running a business, most of the time, in most everyday transactions, you have to benefit somebody else if you're going to benefit yourself. But as we see in the worst kinds of socialist societies, indeed, not even the worst kind of socialist societies, there's plenty of corruption and graft within relatively well-run so-called capitalist societies, when people who follow their own self-interest, when people are greedy and envious and so on, get into the position of power within the state, they can cause an awful lot more damage than they can acting within a market economy.
Absolutely. And in fact, you could say that a market economy is the economic outworking of community. It is how we interact freely as people living in a community together. I lived in the USSR for 3 years, albeit I was very young at the time, and there you can see what happens when you try to take away the natural way in which people interact. particularly that natural way of using money, the way that has grown up organically across every society. People don't stop trying to interact. People don't stop trading with each other. It's just that they have to do it through other media. Suddenly power, influence becomes absolutely essential. Suddenly sex becomes a medium of exchange. And you see so much abuse in societies where the normal way of interacting as human beings gets taken down or dampened down.
And you see it in a different way, say in Venezuela. So Russia was a totalitarian state where there was total state control of people's actions, and people had to try to exchange on an individual basis within that framework and without the authorities really knowing about it. In Venezuela, you really haven't got the capacity for that sort of totalitarian state, and you've got a kind of anarchy instead. Mm-hmm. And you've got greedy, corrupt people running society as a whole without any real accountability. At least businesses are accountable on a day-to-day basis to their customers for providing something useful. Doesn't mean to say they can't indulge in sharp practice and all the rest of it, but to automatically assume state regulation is a substitute for good ethics is a really, I think, serious error, and it's one which is quite often made by clergy when talking about economic issues.
In the Telegraph op-ed, you do write about how flourishing Christian societies with free economies have often been marked by friendly societies, for example, being a good example. You know, you had 7 million members in 1910. And do you think because we're turning... Well, since the creation of the welfare state and since then, the way in which it has grown to the beast that it is today, does that explain the decline of voluntary charity? Does that explain, because it's coerced now, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Well, it's not just a decline of voluntary charity that the welfare state explains the fall of. It's also there's something between charity and the market, which is often described as reciprocity and fraternity. So these organisations, these friendly societies, were not actually vehicles for charity as such, but there were plenty of vehicles for charity as well. They were vehicles for fraternity and reciprocity. Mm-hmm. So things were not exchanged of equal value as they are in a market economy. Obviously not equal value for the people exchanging, but because both parties gain from an exchange. But people joined these friendly societies. It was in their interest to do so, but it was also in their interest to develop a framework for governing those societies which not only provided for those in need but also tried to help those in need in such a way that that need would come to an end. Mm-hmm. And a welfare state is simply almost by construction not capable of doing that type of thing because you just don't have the individual knowledge to be able to work with people to resolve their problems. Whereas friendly societies had a very strong incentive, because there was always a limited pot of money, to actually assist people so that their problems came to an end, to help train the unemployed, to help make an assessment of whether people really were trying to find a job or not. But that also works out in a number of other fields. If you look back at the early 18th century, right up until the mid-1980s, in a lot of other fields, such as finance, you had regulatory bodies which developed from the market themselves, which were very often also vehicles for fraternity. They were very often mutual institutions or clubs. And Thatcher actually, using competition policy, removed the powers of those regulatory bodies because he thought they were exclusive. But actually, they're really good examples of how institutions within the market developed in order to try to restrain bad behaviour. And most of them were on your patch in the city, the stock exchange, and so on. They grew up as clubs, and they had really strict rules on how people behaved. Indeed, we call that act of the Conservative government restricting the powers of these regulatory bodies deregulation, but actually it was the Conservative government interfering in how these clubs actually ran financial markets. And they were entirely voluntary organisations.
Yeah. Marcus?
I think it's important not to forget the huge impact that the welfare state has had on so many people. Many people, particularly those who remember the world before the welfare state, will look on the world now and say that their lives have been saved in a national health service, in hospitals and by doctors whom they would never before have been able to afford, and whose lives have been saved had they become unemployed or found themselves unable to work in another way because of the existence of the welfare state. And I think it's very important not to underestimate the impact that the welfare state has had for good in the country. At the same time, the question needs to be asked whether it's working in the right way. and whether it's working the right way ethically. Until very recently, you had millions upon millions of people who had lived their whole lives on welfare and had no incentive to find a job, and indeed found that the tax system worked against them if they tried to find a job. It is very problematic, ethically, to have people sitting around doing nothing. It's problematic for them. It is bad for people's sense of identity, people's sense of worth, and people's sense of worth with regard to other people.
It becomes a cycle as well.
It becomes a cycle, and then you find children who've seen their parents who've never worked, who themselves then don't try to work. That actually ethically is and was a major problem. Mm-hmm. One of the big successes of the coalition and then the Conservative government has been the huge reduction in the number of people who are long-term unemployed. Mm-hmm. Other questions as to whether the welfare state is able successfully to target its resources at people are questions that should be asked by people both of the right and of the left. Mm-hmm. And of course, this is one of those points where Christians of all different stripes can come to different conclusions and actually should be working together to try to work out what might work best and whether, for example, whether those who are in the small, almost those smallest units in the country, the parishes, actually have got an insight as to how best to work with people who are living within those parishes and need help.
Mm-hmm. And there's a question of prudence here. So Marcus is exactly right. And if you talk to people, obviously decreasing in number now, who were maybe in their 20s or 30s in the late 1940s, they will be able to produce examples from their family when somebody was waiting for an operation, waiting for spectacles or dental treatment or whatever, and they couldn't afford it. There were gaps in the previous provision. But the question is really, what is the role for the state? Is it the role for the state to come along, see those gaps and say, OK, let's have a totally centrally planned system of health provision and pretend that in the whole of the rest of Europe they don't have healthcare because it's not done in the same way? And you often feel that that is the argument that people are making. Or is it the role of the state to help ensure, actually fill in the gaps itself, or potentially help those institutions within society which provide healthcare to fill in the gaps? The particular gaps really were sometimes families of working people, although they were normally covered, but some people who, for whatever reason, couldn't on a long-term basis get health insurance cover mm-hmm. through a friendly society, be provided for by local authority hospitals, and what have you. So there were gaps. Question is how you fill those gaps. And the interesting thing, I think, about the Archbishop's two interventions mm-hmm. a couple of weeks ago, is that everything he pointed to seemed to point in the direction of being anti-market and in favour of more state regulation. So he talked about not everybody benefiting from the increase in incomes and all the rest of it. Well, a major cause of this is very clearly the cost of housing. In London, people are perhaps spending half their income on housing. Why didn't he point to the state regulation of the planning system, which was enacted in the same year, more or less, as the National Health Service, as the key thing which needed to be done to ensure that more homes were built? Why is it that he looked at every problem and pointed to a statist solution? That's a very odd thing to do in a world where the government is spending around 45% of national income and regulates our lives in a way probably hasn't done in the past, has total control of healthcare and a huge control of the way in which people are educated, including the regulation of the university system. Why is it that they keep looking at these problems and think, the solution is yet more state?
I guess that's a good question, Marcus. Why do you think it is that, you know, the Archbishop is calling for more taxation and for more regulation when actually the tax burden is at a 40-odd year high?
One of the great advantages of being an Anglican is the capacity that we have to disagree. And, I mean, some would see it as a weakness, and personally I would see it as a strength, that for the entirety of our history since the break with Rome, we have not agreed with each other on many issues, and yet we all stay within the same church. So what I say now about the Archbishop of Canterbury's speech, I say in love and in friendship. I think that for an awful lot of the clergy, there is a view that business will always be there. It doesn't matter what you do to make their lives more difficult. They will always be there to provide jobs, and rich people will always be there to provide taxes. Actually, we live in a very globalised world where people can move very quickly and to other countries very easily. And we live in a world where it's quite easy to do less if you want to do less, and there's no particular reason to get out of bed and work that little bit harder in order to make your business that little bit better if you really aren't going to benefit from it. The questions of how to make the lives of workers and the lives of those who are earning very little better is a difficult one, but it is not necessarily to make the lives of businesses that much harder. That may well kill the goose that lays the golden egg. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think the problem is focusing so much on those who are not benefiting from the system that you forget that if you end up doing significant damage to those who actually are ensuring that the system keeps going, we'll end up making it much more difficult for businesses to thrive.
So is it the role for the church to promote an even bigger state?
It's the role of the church, it's the role of individuals within the church to speak as they see it. And I wholeheartedly salute the Archbishop of Canterbury for intervening in the debate and hope that the Archbishop of Canterbury will listen to those who disagree with him and will engage with those who disagree with him. In fact, I know that he does do that.
We'll link him to this podcast, don't worry.
Oh, good.
I agree with that, but I think also there was a lack of prudence about what the Archbishop said. His interventions do affect the intellectual climate. That's why the Institute of Economic Affairs is around to try to be active in these spheres. And what the Archbishop said about economic issues, which I'm not entirely sure he understood the consequences of what might be the policies that he would like to see. I think there was a lack of prudence about that intervention. And you don't have to go to Venezuela to see the very undesirable consequences of the types of actions which the Archbishop implied he would like. You know, if you go to a large number of EU countries, you'll find 30% of young people unemployed.
I've been living in Italy for 3.5 years and seen that played out in misery. One of the problems here is actually a problem for us, those of us who would identify ourselves as being on the right of politics. Actually, we have not made the ethical case for the free market or for capitalism, really, for the last 30 years. I think that we felt that this fight was won with the fall of the Berlin Wall. And actually, since the fall of the Berlin Wall, the ethical case has got even stronger. There has never been a greater decline in poverty across the world than we have seen since the fall of the Berlin Wall. There has never been a better time to be alive. There has never been a time when you are less likely to die of preventable diseases. This is substantially, if not actually entirely, down to the freeing up of the markets around the world, to the coming online of countries, of economies that previously were behind protectionist walls or state-controlled walls. The effect on billions of people has been huge and has been hugely positive. And actually, we haven't made that argument.
And the other argument we've maybe made not quite sufficiently, and it's interesting that this is being used by the left against us, is the anthropological case. And this is, if you like, a slightly more Catholic, Thomistic perspective, but just thinking about how we are as human persons, imperfect. So I think that plays out in two ways. One is that we're not omniscient. Very often we pull one policy lever and precisely the opposite of what we hope to happen does happen. And one good example of that is in the field of employment regulation. And that's why we should act with prudence and just be careful and not speak out about these matters unless we have some expertise. But be very careful about how much power we give the state, because our lack of omniscience means that we don't have the knowledge and information to really understand the consequences of our actions, and certainly don't have the knowledge to centrally plan the economy as we've discovered to promote economic welfare. And then the second thing is just our human moral failings. And you know, if human beings are flawed in various ways, it's better to have those human persons interacting individually in a free economy where people are exchanging goods and services by agreement with each other, so you don't have to trade with the nasty individual if you don't want to, rather than have those people in positions of power developing regulations, tax policies and so on, which they may develop to pursue their own interests rather than the interests of the population as a whole. So I think there's a strong anthropological case which people understand regardless of whether or not they're Christians, Muslims or have absolutely no faith at all. People, I think, observe those characteristics of a human person and broadly agree upon them. And therefore, perhaps it's an easier argument to get across to a wide audience than the ethical arguments, which people may understand intuitively, but in today's world, people don't necessarily share the same sort of ethical codes.
If we are all forgiving sinners, we recognise that humans have some failings. Is it right to turn around to your delivery driver, your Uber driver, who is perhaps a student or perhaps someone who needs that flexible working, to turn around and tell them that the industry they're part of is reincarnation of evil, you know, which is what the Archbishop said. If you speak to people who are in these industries, if you look at the polling, people are happy in these, they want these zero-hour flexible contracts. So I wonder, why are we losing that argument, Philip?
I think they're able to get away with that argument because they perceive that the prosperity that's has not been widely shared. But actually what we've seen since the financial crisis is a real decline in productivity growth, more or less to zero. And in the long run, productivity explains wage growth, and that's why wages haven't increased. So there's no real secret about that. And in the last 10 years, there hasn't been a case of the rich getting richer and the poor getting poorer. Incomes have stagnated for a very large number of people. I have to say, if you introduce reforms, which I would like to see, which I think would see real incomes grow significantly, you probably have the Church of England turning around and saying this is a terrible and materialistic capitalistic economy where people only care about earning more money, and as happened, I think, in the 1980s. Back to the point about the Deliveroo driver and so on, I don't think it's a good thing to say to people what you're doing is participating, even if you are the person with whom the cleric is sympathetic in an industry which is the reincarnation of evil, or whatever phrase was used, because that's the type of thing which sows resentment, and sows resentment unnecessarily. Not necessarily in relation to the people who are perfectly happy working in that industry, who may just think that this is just a bit crazy, but amongst other people who might be expected to sympathise with them. You should be measured, or at least careful, in the language you use as a clergyman.
Clergymen are always inclined to preach, and clever clergymen are often inclined to hyperbole as well. I'm not sure that the Archbishop of Canterbury actually meant that this is a manifestation of evil, but he was using hyperbole in a setting at the TUC conference where it would go down very well. In answer to your broader question, in fact, why is it that so many of the clergy look to the state for solutions? I do wonder if a way of looking at this is to see us falling, as a whole, for one of the three temptations of Christ. And I think at different times, different denominations and different groups of clergy will go for the different ones of the temptations. If you remember, first of all, it's turn these stones into bread, and perhaps you could, as Dostoevsky saw in The Brothers Karamazov, offering the people free bread brings them to Christ. In another, it's jump off this temple. Jump off the top of the temple, everybody will see you. It's perhaps use miracles, perhaps even create miracles in order to draw people to you. The third, I think, is the most pernicious. The devil took Jesus to a high mountain and showed him all the kingdoms of the earth and said, if you do but bow down and worship me, I will give you all these. And I think in that temptation is the promise you don't have to go through the cross and the resurrection. You don't have to bring people to you voluntarily. You can make them good. You can impose the kingdom of God on earth now. And that, I think there is always a temptation to believe that we can impose the kingdom of God on earth. And you've seen it with the right, you know. What did the Church of England try and do when Charles I was in power? Well, you've seen it with the left. What have we seen in so many socialist and communist dictatorships? We've seen it with the non-confessing churches in Germany under Adolf Hitler. The view that you can bring about heaven on earth, that we can make the prayer, that line within the Lord's Prayer, thy kingdom come, real here on earth, and we can do it by bypassing the cross and by bypassing the resurrection and by bypassing the need to draw people to us.
There's a place for hyperbole, and Jesus, of course, used hyperbole a lot. Pope Francis uses it a lot. But you have to think carefully, I think, about the context in which you use it. And when a priest is giving a sermon about an example when a priest has used hyperbole, they normally explain the context. And the context is normally the audience being able to understand and being receptive to that use of hyperbole. And therefore, it sort of, if you like, pricks their consciences and they act upon it. I'm not sure that in the world of Twitter, instant news, a TUC conference, when your audience is almost everybody, that is quite the right place for that type of hyperbole, especially when you're talking about people's everyday working lives.
Because it seemed to be the reaction was those on the left absolutely adored it and started to think that the Archbishop was the best thing since sliced bread. And then those on the right screamed, this is virtue signalling, you know, how dare you, etc., etc. But I want to turn to something that you also mention in the op-ed, where you say that the market runs all the way through the Bible. And I wonder if you might briefly elaborate on that.
Okay. Well, I'm a Catholic, so knowledge of the Bible is not necessarily my strong point. Mm. That's a bit of a Catholic in-joke, I suppose. But the Bible is about people's everyday lives, marked by exchange, trade. This is also true, actually, of Islam, the history of Islam too. Trade and exchange, inheritance, tax, and a just role for government. And this, of course, just runs all the way through the Bible. And then the question is then, how does Jesus pick up on this? At no point does he say inheritance is wrong, because there are warnings about storing things up and you not being able to take advantage of them when you're gone and all the rest of it. But the parable of the prodigal son, for example, has inheritance at its heart. Mm-hmm. It has work, the market, prosperity at its heart. Jesus does not tend to criticise those sorts of things in and of themselves. He criticises people's ethical actions within a market, people's ethical attitude towards wealth, people replacing God by wealth as a God, and so on. I was asked by the editors of the Telegraph to sort of try to have a sort of biblical context to this. Mm-hmm. And in a sense, it's difficult because it's just an underlying narrative. Yes. Because the Bible is a series of stories, you know, the history of the Jewish people and then the New Testament, which describes how people live, and the market is part and parcel of that.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. Marcus, would you find it easy to give a sermon on the virtues of capitalism?
I would not give a sermon on the virtues of capitalism. I would see it as an abuse of the pulpit.
Yes.
I would say it's different speaking here mm-hmm. on a radio programme about what I feel mm-hmm. with regard to capitalism and the free market and the economy. I think if I were to get up into the pulpit and do this,
yes.
I would have abused the pulpit.
Yes.
I mean, sometimes my priest, not really sure whether he's in favour of a market economy or not, which is possibly a good thing that I don't know that. Sometimes there are contexts in which you can make useful pedagogical points. So, for example, I remember my priest, when giving the sermon on the clearing out of the temple, actually made the point that Jesus wasn't saying that all exchange and selling stuff and all the rest of it
was absolutely
wrong, but the context was wrong. It shouldn't have been done there, and it shouldn't have been done in that way, by people deliberately ripping people off because of the way that the temple coinage worked and so on. Those pedagogical points are sometimes quite useful, because you can read a story like that and think Jesus is chucking these people out of the temple and is saying that people shouldn't buy and sell stuff. No, he's saying that people shouldn't buy and sell stuff there, and people shouldn't buy and sell stuff in that way. But buying and selling stuff is the everyday business of life for most people in those times.
I suppose there is always a question as to how a person who should be leading people spiritually, or at least being accompanying them spiritually, can also be publicly political, particularly in an intensely fractious political environment such as we have right now. And this is something that I wrestle with. I suppose I take my lead from the Archbishop of Canterbury and believe that it is fair to engage in the public sphere as a clergyman. However, when you're in the pulpit, I think that that isn't the right place. Obviously, my perspective will colour what I'm seeing in the scripture, and I hope that the scriptures will also colour what I see in the rest of the world.
I see what you're saying, but it seems to be acceptable to get up and give a sermon on, say, the NHS, and not being able to talk about the fact that poverty reduction is a miracle of free market capitalism.
I mean, on the other hand, when the next Jubilee comes along, and I look forward to Her Majesty's next major Jubilee, I shall certainly be standing up, and I suppose that will be quite a political sermon.
Yeah.
Itself. I would say that if the one thing that you're getting out of the text is, I can make a point about the free market, or I can make a point about the NHS, actually you probably have to take a step back and ask yourself whether that really is the one thing or the main thing that you're getting out of the text that you're preaching on.
Mm-hmm. I agree exactly, precisely with Marcus's position. But I think there is a problem that those on the left, because of the way they view the importance of government, regard politics as far more important than those who believe in free markets do. So for people who believe in free markets, politics is enabling, and in a sense should be at the edges of society. Absolutely vitally important, like the oil that goes around the engine, but something which is really perhaps not that visible. For somebody on the left, politics is actually the answer to almost every question. And therefore, it's not surprising, perhaps, that somebody on the left will preach about these things from the pulpit more than somebody who broadly believes in a market economy. And that sort of produces an imbalance, perhaps. And the NHS will be a good example of that. Plenty of Old Testament opportunities to talk about looking after the widow and the orphan. But it's a heck of a leap to go from there to suggest that the state should provide, run and centrally plan the entire health service. But some people strangely make that leap.
Why are we losing the moral argument, I think, is the fundamental question, isn't it, really?
We haven't been making it.
Well, exactly, but why? Why is that?
Why have we not been making the moral argument? I would say until the financial crash, most people on the right, and probably most people on the left, thought that the great debates of the 20th century were over. Even if people mocked Francis Fukuyama about the end of history, perhaps what actually was felt was that there was an end of economics. The free market had won, capitalism had won, liberalism had won. With the financial crash of 2008, Marx has risen from the dead. A zombie, an odd zombie when you see the Corbynistas sitting in an expensive coffee house playing with their iPads on their Samsung phones, tweeting about bringing down capitalism. But nonetheless, Marx coming back from the dead. And I think that for the last 10 years, really probably until Corbyn's surprisingly successful showing at the last general election, we still felt that the argument had been won and that it was people who just didn't understand what was going on who were making these zombie Marxist points. And now, this year, really, I think people on the right, particularly people, Christians on the right, have started realising this is a fight that needs to be entered again.
Do you see that, Philip?
I do. I'm not sure that for a very long period of time those on the free market side of the debate, I hesitate to use the word right, have successfully made the moral argument. And at the moment, I'm not sure that such people are successfully making any argument which is really resonating. So the argument of the huge reduction in poverty, for example, the last 20 years is the first sustained period in the whole of the last 200 years where global inequality has been falling. You hardly get anybody mentioning that in the intellectual sphere at all. So I'm not sure that people are making any argument, never mind the moral argument. I'm not sure, but I think there is a tendency towards reductionist thinking amongst most people, that if there is a problem and if there is an apparently straightforward solution of pulling a policy lever, and if that doesn't appear to impinge upon people's freedom to too great a degree, then the means are justified by the ends, even if in fact actually the ends turn out to be the opposite of what you'd expect.
For more podcasts, blogs, films and reports, go to our website, iea.org.uk.